Hello, and welcome to Learning for Life at Gustavus, the podcast about people teaching and learning at Gustavus Adolphus College, and the myriad ways that Gustavus liberal arts education provides a lasting foundation for lives of fulfillment and purpose. I'm your host, Greg Castor, faculty member in the Department of History. Today's episode of the podcast is number 150. Joining me to mark this milestone is my special guest, Marcia Page, chair of the Gustavus Board of Trustees. A 1982 graduate of Gustavus with an MBA from the University of Minnesota, Marcia has enjoyed a distinguished career as an investment professional. In 1993, along with fellow Gustie George Hicks, and I should add he was a history major, she co-founded the privately held global alternative investment firm Varde Partners, where she is currently co-executive chair. She's also a founder and CEO, of Empowered Capital, an investment firm in partnership with Varde, committed to, as its website states, accelerating the growth of diverse investment managers. In recognition of her trailblazing accomplishments in the global investment industry, the University of Minnesota named her its 2017 Entrepreneur of the Year. In addition to her work as a Gustavus trustee, Marcia is also involved in Gustavus Women in Leadership, and she and her husband, 1980 Gustavus grad John Hoopenbecker, have been generous supporters of the college, including endowing a professorship of international business and entrepreneurship. Speaking at Fordham University's Business School in 2019, Marcia observed that, quote, "Fundamentally, I think of myself as a liberal arts graduate with some technical finance skills." How I love that quote. And that self-understanding, together with her distinguished career and leadership of the Gustavus Board, make her the perfect choice for this 150th episode, and I'm delighted she could join me to talk about her background, career, and alma mater. So welcome, Marcia. It's so great to have you on the show.
Thank you so much, Greg. It's really fun to be part of it, and it's an honor to be the 150th.
That makes me feel good. Thank you. Yeah, I was talking to Barb Larson Taylor. You know Barb, of course, and who helps with the podcast. We're trying to who should we invite, and then we both thought, yeah, Marcia, of course, because the 100th was President Bergman, which was fun. The 50th was turned on me. I was the person interviewed by someone else. Actually, if you know Kathy Lundeen, it was her idea in econ management. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, so absolutely. You're the perfect choice, seriously, and it couldn't be better. And so thanks. I know you're busy, although you said the firm is closed. It's President's Day when we're recording, so the firm isn't open today.
Technically, I'm not working.
Okay. All right. Technically. Yeah. I hear you. Yeah. Well, happy President's Day. And again, thanks.
Thank you.
So I like to start with people's own backgrounds. And so let's do that. Let's start with yours. Tell us a little bit about where you grew up, first of all.
Yeah. So I grew up in Olivia, Minnesota. It's about 75 miles northwest of St. Peter. I joke that it's the self-proclaimed corn capital of the world. Oh. And in fact, Greg, it has a 50-foot monument in the shape of an ear of corn.
Oh, perfect.
To prove the point, right?
Yeah.
The town was a wonderful crucible for growing up and learning about community, about business and relationships. My parents were among a group of leaders who were, you know, really an inspiring and influential force for change and development. And they encouraged my curiosity and independence. So really, starting at about 10 years old, I spent most of my evenings and weekends working for my dad in his drugstore.
Oh, wow.
We worked really shoulder to shoulder, and he helped me to enjoy the measurability of business. He taught me how to provide exceptional customer service by way of example. And then when we got to dinner, he'd seek advice from my two brothers and me, and those experiences were indelible. And I guess I'd have to credit my dad with probably that entrepreneurial instinct and drive. And then my mom was a force of her own. She brought a no-limits approach to everything that she did. She challenged the status quo. She chose to run for the first female mayor when I was in high school. Her regular letters to the editor kept the town on its toes.
And that's great.
She was a deaconess, actually, in the Lutheran church. And so she was very active in our church lives. And so, like, growing up in a small town, you did a little bit of everything. I begged my parents to let me take piano lessons when I was in elementary school, and took piano lessons all the way through high school and into college at Gustavus, and accompanied choirs and played in the church, accompanied individuals.
Do you still play the piano?
I do, but not nearly as adept as I used to. So okay. I feel a little frustrated and intimidated by sitting down with music that I can't play like I used to play.
Yeah. Did your dad own his drugstore? Was it wasn't a chain or was it?
No, he owned the drugstore. He had a franchise with what was then called Snyder Drugstore.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But he actually bought into the store. My parents moved from South Dakota to Olivia in the year I was born. And he bought into the first drugstore, ultimately moved to a second store. And then when it became a Snyder franchise, finally built his third largest store. So we were also part of, I guess, as a family, helping grow that business and watch it develop.
Was he actually a pharmacist or just the sort of business guy?
No, he was a pharmacist. So my college decision hinges in very much with the conviction that I was going to become a pharmacist, which,
aha,
given your introduction, spoiler alert, you know that didn't happen.
That did not happen. Yeah, I love that. My parents were small business people. As I mentioned before we started recording, my dad, you know, worked for a big beauty salon company, actually headquartered in Minnesota at the time, Maxim's, but also then had his own salons. And like you, I just have one sibling, 2 years younger, my brother. We were the cleanup boys in the salon. And while we didn't go into hairdressing, we learned, as you did, so many lessons about work, business. And you said two magic words for me: customer service, which I am obsessed about and don't like when I don't get it, no matter where I am. And it's interesting, you mentioned your dad would consult not just your brothers, but you. Were you the only daughter?
Yes, indeed. And by the way, we share that view on customer service. And I always take notice when there's excellent customer service. And I also started with cleaning at the drugstore. But absolutely. One of the things that I reflect back on is I probably, for a girl in the 60s and 70s, was socialized quite differently from many girls of my vintage, so to speak, and very similar to my brothers. So we were shoulder to shoulder in virtually everything, including taking advice.
Yeah, that's great. Your dad, how conscious he was of this or not was, as you say, was really raising you in some ways out of the norm, right? Or out of the, whatever, the traditional tracks. That's great. That's wonderful. It's a wonderful gift, obviously. Did your brothers go, any of your brothers go into the pharmacy business?
Okay, you're going to get a kick out of this. All three of us started out with the idea that we were going to be pharmacists. And about, and I think it was organic chemistry that destroyed all three of us at some point.
Oh, yeah, that'll do it.
And so each of us, about our sophomore year, would, call my dad and say, hey, it's not going to happen.
That's funny. And so he retired, and then the business did he sell the business or something? Or?
Ultimately, he sold the business, but he stayed in there working, I think, until he was about 85 years old, at least part-time.
Wow.
Yes.
That's great.
Yes.
That's fantastic.
Ooh, yeah, lovely story.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And are your parents passed away or now? Or are they still?
They are now.
Yeah, sorry.
And thank you. I really appreciate that. They were remarkable leaders, mentors, and parents.
Yeah, your mom sounds great. I like writing letters to the editor. And apparently one of my uncles, my dad was Greek American, my parents are passed away also, but one of my uncles wrote so many to the Chicago Tribune that they're archived in the Chicago Historical Society. So have that in common with your mom too. Yeah, she sounds like a force and an important role model also. Did your parents, had they gone to college or not? My mother went to a 2-year teacher college. That was it.
Yes, interestingly, we had quite a history. My mom was a Valparaiso grad.
Oh, yeah, wow.
And was a major, double major in social, really social studies and religion at the time.
Okay.
And thereby became a deaconess. My dad was a pharmacist, as I mentioned.
So, of course, he went to college, yeah.
Yep, South Dakota State University. And they met in summer school at South Dakota State University in the 1950s. All four of my grandparents also were college graduates.
Wow.
including my maternal grandmother, who was a Gustavus graduate in probably right around 1925.
Wow.
And family lore tells us that she was the first woman student body president at Gustavus, but I've never confirmed it directly.
Wow. So Do you know her name? Do you remember her name?
Yeah, absolutely.
No, I shouldn't say remember. Go ahead. What is it? I'm writing it down.
Yes, Ruth Peterson. And now her married name was Youngeman. So she would have been Ruthie Peterson in the 1920s.
That's great. I'm tracking her down because I'm deep into research into the archives here that are online, the student yearbooks and newspapers. And so Ruth Peterson, thank you. That's interesting. So you come from a long line of college educated. I don't know if I'm not a first gen. My mom was 2-year teacher college, but I'm kind of a first gen as far as I'm concerned, like a lot of our students. Why Gustavus? So, I mean, was she had anyone gone to Gustavus after her? Or you were it?
Not really. I was it. So, you know, really it was this idea that I was going to become a pharmacist. I was convinced. So Dad wanted me to go to South Dakota State University, his alma mater. My mom came from a liberal arts college tradition. And she was like, Marcia, you will be able to take your first 2 years of piano lessons as part of the Gustavus tuition. And ultimately decide on Gustavus. But I was convinced that I would take those 2 years of piano lessons. I would stay for 2 years, get all of my basic, you know, coursework under my belt. And then after 2 years, I was going to transfer to a pharmacy program.
Wow.
So that was the going in idea. And I had enormous conviction that that was the way it was going to go.
Oh, I love this because it didn't go that way, obviously, as we've said. So what happened?
Well, for starters, I have to say when I arrived at Gustavus, I was pretty overwhelmed. My graduating class in Olivia was about 67 kids. Mm-hmm. I didn't even know what a syllabus was. the reading list for my first semester, and I don't think I'm really exaggerating, it was longer than my cumulative lifetime reading up to that point.
Probably.
And it was mind-blowing. And I also could tell that I was academically behind those students who had come from, and I'm putting in air quotes, the cities,
yes,
end of air quotes, right?
Right.
So, you know, I got into that wrestling match in my pursuit of becoming a pharmacist, that battle with organic chemistry, and I lost pretty dramatically.
So did you have a backup plan or not? You just sort of lost and then what? I mean,
no, I really, you know, I didn't have a backup plan. But what started happening really by the time I was a sophomore is things started to kind of fall into place for me. Among other things, by the way, importantly, I had developed those friendships with just already with such great people. I met my future husband, John Hoopenbecker, and I had to start to shift that thinking from that initial pharmacy path. And it was by then, it was clear I had a capacity for math, for business. I found those classes super interesting. And what really hooked me was when I took a January term class. It was called Math of Finance. I believe the math professor was Dr. Brew. And basically, we did proving and practicing of present value and future value and return calculations. And it made complete sense to me. I understood how it worked and how it was practical and how it was also investable. So that was really, I would say, the turning point for, you know, deciding that I would stay at Gustavus, that I wasn't going to become a pharmacist. But another really meaningful event happened at that time. I mentioned that my father had built that new drugstore in Olivia.
Right.
When we started this whole adventure, my parents and I hadn't budgeted in 2 more years at Gustavus.
Okay.
So we struggled with that hurdle of how are we going to finance those last 2 years at Gustavus, particularly with the fact that we had just built this larger drugstore. And so my parents came up to Gustavus, and we approached at the time Owen Samuelson. And
oh,
described
sure.
This, do you remember him?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And we basically described a situation to him, explained what had happened. And fast forward, when an anonymous donor filled in the difference in my tuition for my last 2 years at Gustavus. I still get emotional when I think about it.
Oh my gosh.
It was unbelievable.
That's life-changing, obviously.
It was life-changing.
Yeah.
And it was completely unexpected. And it was really that moment where you learn that you're the beneficiary of actions and gifts that were well beyond your view.
Right.
So just a remarkable, and as you said, life-changing experience for me. At the end of the day, I graduated with an economics major and finished that minor in music.
Oh, wonderful. Good. Now, I love these stories for so many reasons, as regular listeners know, because too many of our students think they have to have everything figured out at the start, and that whatever they start out with is what they're going to end up with. And of course, look at you, not true. How did your dad take the news about, you're not going into pharmacy? Was it okay?
It was absolutely okay. And maybe he had the instinct early on that maybe that wasn't the way it was going to go, right? Mm-hmm. But he was gracious and appreciated the work that it had gotten to be able to make that change and that decision. So as always, he was a patient and gracious and lovely man, and that's how he took the news.
That's really nice. What a great, great story. Did you, we can come back to philanthropy. That's you are a philanthropist now, and you were the beneficiary of that at the time as a student. What about, you've touched on this a little bit already, but particular memories that stand out, whether it's about academics. I don't know if you were involved in choir or sports or, what we now call co-curricular, used to be called extracurricular, as a student at Gustavus. I'm just curious what, kind of asking you to, it's hard, I know, to remember some of these things.
So many memorable experiences, both academic and co-curricular. Just as an aside, I remember the very first day sitting in Christ Chapel with my parents and my two brothers, and singing with voices in the organ at a scale that I had never experienced, and having President Lindell comment on the high academic quality of the incoming class. And again, as I mentioned earlier, I was coming from a class of 67 in Olivia to a college campus that was the size of my hometown. It's still a really memorable moment for me. But I would just say I worked hard as a student. I loved the course offerings, the classroom experiences, the amazing professors. I still remember the first class where I got an A on a descriptive writing exercise.
Oh, great.
Daily Chapel was wonderful. Chaplain Elvie definitely pushed my thinking.
Oh, he was amazing, yeah.
He was extraordinary.
Dick Elvie, Richard Elvie, yeah.
Richard Elvie. How about my work study? Cleaning tables daily in the CAF with Ma Young, who is quite a force.
Oh,
right?
She's another force, yeah. I've only heard, yeah.
She was a true force, ultimately tutored calculus. So there was the work study that was part of the experience, but I wasn't in sports. I was, all of the piano and music was really individual work. So certainly had to do a couple of concerts that were more individual in nature. But honestly, to me, the shared experiences that bring the sense of community to Gustavus were part of the fun of it. I was the president of the sorority, Tau Mu Tau, at the time.
Oh, okay.
Really smart, creative, fun women. And I was part of the era of barn parties. So
I've heard about those.
I can still remember the first Halloween party and some of the costumes that were unbelievably creative. And just having shared experiences in the classroom and beyond, I would just say that community feeling is, and that gusty spirit literally shaped me. And I still feel that way when I come back to Gustavus or see a gusty anywhere.
Mm. Yeah, it's this is kind of music to my ears for a number of reasons, but I'll just state one. I too, I did, I was sort of, you know, tentatively a football player in high school, just the first couple of years, very tentatively, actually. Anyway, but in college, I loved my coursework. And yeah, I loved hanging out with people and getting to know people. And that was it. So I didn't pursue, I probably wasn't good enough anyway. I must have been at Division I school, I suppose, Northern Illinois University. But I mean, it's good for students to understand that someone, as in your case, can be successful. Didn't have to do 150, you know, activities. I mean, we have this, I know young people, you know, it starts early, I guess, but oh my God, you know, all the, it's enough. Pick one or two. You don't need to be in everything, you know, do a couple of things really well. You'll be fine.
Remember, Greg, that the coursework was demanding for me, you know, like just getting up the curve and
that's right.
operating at a high level of excellence as a student. You know, that took plenty of time for me.
Right. I wish I could go back in time. Some just based partly on my research and talking to people like you and others. But in some ways, I think the professors were even more demanding. And maybe they could be because there were fewer distractions. I'm just not sure. But I've heard many people speak about the you know amount of reading. Oh, I have a friend in the building. He's an alum, Bradley B. Peter Smith, and lives in our condo in Minneapolis. His dad went to Gustavus, and his dad must be in his 90s. His dad gave Peter recently, and then Peter gave to me one of his dad's course books. In literature, and he's writing in it, and I'm looking at the assignments, you know, the pages that they're expected to read. I think I'd be drummed out of the classroom if I tried that. I don't know. Anyway, so I like that you know you were busy, but it didn't involve necessarily you know running track or this or that. So that's all fine. You did well. You graduate, obviously. And not what you plan to do, and you're not going to be a pharmacist. So tell us a little bit about what happens next. How do you, I mean, do you work your way into the financial, I don't know if you call it the investment industry, whatever you want to call it right away, or were there some other twists and turns?
I'd say a couple twists and turns. So 1982, the year I graduated, a recession was in full swing. And we're talking soaring inflation, historically high interest rates, and an incredibly high unemployment rate. So there weren't exactly a lot of offers out there. My options included a junior retail analyst position and, interestingly, the opportunity to actually go back for my MBA at the University of Minnesota. Now, that option generally doesn't exist to go right from undergraduate to an MBA in the current environment, but that was an option at the time. So I took out another loan and finished that MBA with a focus in finance and started setting out on my interviews. Ultimately, I interviewed with a person by the name of Bob Lumpkins at Cargill for a financial analyst role. And Bob single-handedly convinced me to ditch any other options and join Cargill. I joined Cargill's, it was called at the time Financial Information Services, in the summer of 1983. And I joined a kind of a small group of MBAs. And we basically stood in as a resource pool for financial analysis and annual reporting across the firm. And about 2 years later, and this is going to get to your question, is how do you get to investing? I got a call from Bob Lumpkins. And by the way, he was a real sponsor for me, distinguished from the concept of a mentor in that he really was looking to give me really interesting projects and visibility in the firm. And he was kind of putting chits on me. So he calls me on a Friday afternoon and he says, "Hey, do you know what a high yield bond is?" And I told him that I did, but I'm going to be honest, I wasn't completely sure. So I spent the entire weekend working on this stack of papers in front of me, came in Monday morning, and upon my 25-year-old recommendation, he and other folks basically went out and bought $5 million in high-yield bonds on my recommendation.
Wow. Okay. That's great.
That was the turning point. Right?
That's fantastic. Well, you knew the answer to the question. You should not say, "No, I don't know." You knew enough to say, you know, and then you had time to cram and figure it out and offer
totally,
advice.
Totally. Yeah,
I hope it worked. I hope your advice worked out well too for the
It did. It totally worked out. It wasn't the most interestingly structured bond. I still can remember factors around it. So I learned a lot since then. But it did not, it worked out just fine. But it was that first step in expanding my view of what was possible in the financial markets. And there was the next step in my career because I transferred to what was then called this financial markets department and spent 3 years basically on an investing and trading desk. It was a very energizing place with diverse talent and capital and a willing spirit to kind of try anything. It was really entrepreneurial. And I just traded in a range of markets and trading tools. And the next step was that a couple of folks on that trading desk announced in August of 1988 that they were going to start their own hedge fund. And they were the same key executives that had heard that high yield pitch 3 years prior. And I think, again, that entrepreneurial edge kicked in, and I informed them that I wanted to join their brand new startup effort. And so I started what was basically a brand new hedge fund in a brand new hedge fund firm in October of 1988. At the ripe old age of 28, I would never have been able to appreciate that I was part of a group of pioneers in what would become this massive alternatives hedge fund industry.
Yeah, the industry, my God. Yeah.
It was a cottage industry at the time. It was, people were just trying to figure it out. And now it's this institutional, multi-trillion asset kind of part of the markets. And it was, with the benefit of hindsight, then one of those once in a lifetime set of circumstances. So I basically ran a portfolio of liquid credit strategies. I worked independently, I committed capital, and I learned a ton.
That's amazing. You're 28. My God, you're only, you're like 5 years, 6 years out of Gustavus.
Well, I had put 10 years, you're right. But at 10 years when it was, when I finally moved from there to Vardé.
Okay,
right.
I see.
I was young.
But young, yeah. The, you know, one question just quickly. I know we're gonna talk about Vardé in a second, but what is alternative investment? I mean, what does that mean?
Yeah, so think of alternative investments as really being a range of types of strategies that are not your classic publicly traded equities or stocks or publicly traded bond strategies. So, you know, it would not be inclusive of most of the stocks that you would see in an index or that are publicly traded. In fact, they tend to be less liquid strategies and often in more private related fund strategies. And so the idea is that they're alternatives to classic public equity and bond markets.
Okay. Perfectly clear explanation. Thank you. You know, what is it? What were you thinking? Was it just, I'm tired? I mean, you said the entrepreneurial edge kicked in. I mean, I wonder if you can say a little bit more about that. Was it just this chance to do something new? Had you become sort of, I've done this part of Cargill and I want to do something completely different? I mean, you were now leaving Cargill, right? I mean, I wonder what was going through your mind?
Yeah.
Were you scared? Were you like, oh my God, I don't know.
Should have been a little more, you know, but you're right. At 5 years, you know, at Cargill, I think it was just this idea that it was going to be a really interesting startup and that I was going to be working with people that had demonstrated success and that I was going to have this opportunity to participate really in the equity of the business in a way by being an early participant in their new business and in their new fund.
Right.
And so it I guess it was the excitement of something that was new and where I would be able to like participate in growing the business and being a beneficiary of that business.
Yeah, that makes sense. Were you, and the other question I had, well, first a comment, you've already said something really important that Bob, I'm forgetting his last name.
Yeah, Bob Lumpkins.
Yes, you mentioned, I think that's an important distinction, not just a mentor, but I mean, more than that. And again, especially for students who might be listening, it's something, you know, your profs, we try to stress all the time, but these connections matter. Networking sometimes gets a bad name. Not that this was networking, you and Bob, but you know, we all need help and we all have mentors or people who are doing more than just mentoring. It's helping us get places, go places and looking out for us. And so I just think that's really important. And again, you know, who knows? You didn't know him in advance or did you? You just interviewed with him?
No, I interviewed with him and I think he just saw something in me and he would say, you know, I kept throwing projects at you to see how you'd respond, right? And when you create something and you bring your best to bear on it and repeatedly create an excellent product, then you develop this well of mutual respect and trust. Mm. So I just think it's a combination. I think there is a very powerful networking, but I would put a lot of what happened with Bob is just a building of a relationship and a working relationship that built on that well of credibility.
Right.
By the way, he is still a mentor to this day.
Oh, wow.
So we have stayed in touch all of these years.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I just saw him again last week.
Oh.
And I think it goes in the category of long-term relationships and remembering that most things that we do also very much hinge on developing relationships.
Yes.
And this is a perfect example of that.
Yes. That's great. I hope you'll listen to the podcast at some point. That's great. It's wonderful. And again, another comment, then a question, but, in retrospect, this might seem, you know, like it's all sort of, it had to happen the way it happened. But of course, that's not the case. And even as you're telling it, it doesn't really sound that way. There's so many moments when it could have gone a different way. I mean, what if you had interviewed with someone other than Bob, right? Who knows, right? Even if you had done a good job. So that's why I think students and all of us really need to be open, as you clearly were, be open to possibilities, not worry about everything getting all figured out in advance. Because even if you can figure it all out in advance, it may well not go that way anyway. So that's
Greg,
my little aside. Go ahead.
Well, if I can do an aside on your aside, I completely agree with you. And I think that's one of the things that has been a repeatable piece for me is that I was willing to make the leap. I didn't tick the box on every single characteristic or requirement for the job or the role or to take a leap and try something new.
Right.
I was willing to get to about 50-60% and actually say, you know what, I can figure out the rest of it as I go. And if there's, I think people see that as a big risk. I actually thought of it as something that requires some confidence and resilience.
Right.
But for really, you know, for folks who are smart and willing to kind of give it a go, you usually can figure it out. And
yes.
You don't have to have it all sorted in advance.
That's right. And so many things, if we had to have everything sorted out in advance, I don't know, we wouldn't get out of bed, right? And there certainly wouldn't be any entrepreneurialism. It's just, no, I couldn't agree more. And then I wonder about, we'll come back to this, I think, when we talk about Empowered, but what about, are you essentially one of the few, probably not the only women in the industry at that point when you're with Cargill? I mean, how many women were doing what you were doing?
Well, it's really interesting. So if I put myself back at that point in time, I was on that trading desk with a really diverse group of talent, men and women. And it was really when I moved to the chair role at Vardae, and I know we're going to come back to that. That's
yes.
2015 when I looked around and said, wait, where did everybody go? How is it possible that I'm one of the few women in this industry that has actually built a firm with decades of a track record and to scale in the alternatives business? And when I look back on all of the years now that I have under my belt, it's stunning to me that I am one of the few women that's done that in the alternatives industry.
I know we'll get into this even more when we talk about Empower, but what do you think explains that? Is it just, I mean, one could say, well, they're just not as ambitious as you or as willing to take risks, or is there some structural issue? Sexism? I don't know.
Well, it's actually an interesting combination of structural barriers that have been built up, I think, in the industry, as well as, yes, unconscious bias. Mm-hmm. And it's a complicated mix, but in the way I've thought about it, it's kind of created this circular conundrum that's been very hard to, you know, allow talent to kind of break out of during this last period of time. So it's a whole nother podcast for us, Greg, down the road.
But I'm sure
it really is an interesting combination of what I call structural and unconscious barrier.
Well, I know
unconscious bias barriers.
Yeah, and that's a good way to put it too. And but you just reminded me when Kate and I, my wife, who taught at Gustavus, who now retired, we came here in 1986. And honestly, I used to kind of joke, you know, here's how Gustavus could raise money, be a living history museum of the 1950s, because coming from Boston, it seemed, I mean, first of all, there were very few women faculty, you know, there were some, but it was really quite male dominated. I mean, many departments, there was, in our department, Kate was the first tenure track or tenured woman certainly, and the only woman for a long time. Yeah,
very extraordinary. But it is exciting to see the progress that's been made.
Absolutely.
In the last 10 and 20 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, part of the work and we'll talk about it on Empowered Capital, is really to create the catalysts that allow for those breakout opportunities on the investing side as well.
Right, exactly. What, so you're with this, I don't know if you said the name of the firm that you founded with these other people. What was that called?
That was called EBF and Associates. And the firm, or the fund that I managed, was called Merced Partners. They've now adopted the name Merced Partners for their firm as we sit here today, and it still exists.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic. That must be gratifying. When did you connect? So you didn't meet George Hicks at Gustavus. When did you connect with George and decide to found Varde? And there's one other founder, I believe, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So George Hicks and Greg McMillan and I co-founded Varde Partners in 1993. And it really started, again, maybe that entrepreneurial edge that I have, with this desire now to start a new fund and a new business. And I was resolved to start this new firm. Well, I had worked together with George Hicks and Greg McMillan at Cargill.
Okay.
And these are one of these moments of serendipity.
Yes.
George and Greg really started thinking about doing something on their own. They had stayed at Cargill. And here we are in the summer of 1993, and we got together and started thinking about the power of doing something together. And this notion of bringing a range of complementary skill sets that each of us had developed in the intervening period of time around the investing side that would really play to our complementary skills and represent a distinctive offering in the market. And so we basically, instead of doing it on our own, decided to come together amongst the three of us and co-found Varde Partners.
That's fantastic. And I'm thinking, help me with my math. I'm even not as good at math as you, but that's you said 1993. So you're about, that's 11 years after Gustavus, right? I mean, a decade or so.
Yeah, I'm 33 years old.
Yeah, it's amazing. That's phenomenal. And it's still a private firm, is it? Or is it?
Yes, it is still a private firm. So ultimately, when we fast forward to today, we built a leading global alternative investment management firm, and the firm is currently managing about $13 billion in assets under management. Greg retired in 2008. I moved to the co-chair role in 2015, and George Hicks recently moved from the active management of the firm to co-chair Varde with me. And so now the firm has completely been turned over to the next generation of leadership.
That's really exciting. It's amazing, the numbers. And is it, I mean, it's global, as you just said. So does a firm like yours have then offices around the world, or is it just people working around the world?
Yeah, no, we have offices we started the firm in Minneapolis. So an office in Minneapolis, and other key offices in New York, London, and Singapore. And I have to say, one of the highlights was actually having the opportunity to move our family to London. And that was in about 2005 to 2006 to help establish Värde's presence in Europe. So one of those amazing periods where you combine your personal, professional, and family life and have enormous growth associated with that. So
that's great.
It's truly a global firm with global presence in multiple cities.
How many people roughly work for Värde?
Yeah, roughly 200, over 200.
It's a lot. That's a lot.
It's a lot. It's a lot.
I mean, I don't know about the industry, but it's not like, you know, just four people in an office or you and George and was it Greg McWilliams?
And Greg McMillan, yeah. Exactly.
McMillan. He didn't go to Gustavus, or did he?
No, he didn't. But one of his sons, TJ McMillan, went to Gustavus.
Oh, all right. Well, we'll take
it. And one of his daughter-in-laws.
That's great. I mean, it's so, and you mentioned London. Kate and I, we love London. We got to take Gustavus students to England there was a short-lived Gustavus semester abroad program way, way back when where we were in London and Leeds. Yeah, it's just exciting. I don't know, maybe I just like financial capitals. You know, I love New York City and I love London. Anyway.
It's still my favorite city. I don't know.
I love it.
I am fascinated. There's so much to do.
I agree. And I mean, some people say, London, really? Have you been to London? It's amazing. It's an incredible city, world city, like New York. So, you found that, and I mean, that is still going. I don't know, co-running it, co-leading it, whatever you want to call it. But then you also found Empowered, and that's M with an M, the letter M, right? And then Powered.
Absolutely, yes.
And is that, as I said in my intro, it's kind of, it's in partnership with Värde. Correct me if I'm wrong. Just tell us a little bit about that founding and what Empowered is about.
Yeah, thank you. So I founded Empowered in 2020. Really as a second investment management firm. And the idea really is that we're looking to invest in best-in-class talent across the alternative markets and specifically addressing this lack of funding for female and other underrepresented investors.
Okay.
The connection with Värde is that we affiliated with Värde. So Empowered Capital is a wholly separate investment management firm that I run together with a team. We affiliated with Värde to basically provide the supporting infrastructure for compliance and legal and office space and IT support, as well as business development and investor relations support. So all of the non-investing pieces are really run through the Värde affiliation. So it's been an incredible partnership of being able to bring together all of the connectivity and talent and infrastructure and experience at Värde to help us really found Empowered and be able to launch it in an institutional quality way.
That's really great. And I have to say, I saw a photo, and I went to the Empowered webpage, and there's just this, it's an amazing photo. You're in it, but there's maybe one guy in it, if I remember, but it's just... It's not just that there are women, it's the diversity of the women as well. I just think that was, I found that to be very powerful, that photo. And I have to say, if I were coming as a client, that would be attractive to me, that alone.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. We're very excited about the mission for Empowered as well.
Yeah, you should be. It's important. And you've done, I think I'm keeping count. You've co-founded two and founded one, right? You didn't have a co-founder for Empowered, or did you?
No, not for Empowered. So you're right. I'm the founder.
Yeah. So talk about entrepreneurism. And I sometimes tease students if George Hicks's name comes up, or I say this about Warren Beck too, of Beck Hall, where I'm sitting right now, Warren Beck and Donna Beck. Warren, you know, I say, what can you do with a history major? I don't know, go out and, you know, make a lot of money and give back to the college, you know, as George has done and Warren was a history major, as I think I just said. So anyway, this idea that, oh my God, what am I going to do with a history major? And that brings me to your work as a board member and chair. When did you join the board? I was trying to find that and I couldn't.
Yeah, so I actually had to do a little bit of work on that as well. So I joined the Board of Trustees in 2015.
Okay.
So I'm deep into my my board of trustee work.
And it's a three, is it 3-year terms? Is that how it works, I think?
Up to 4 3-year terms.
Up to so 4 3-year terms.
Me, yep. So that gets me to a term limit in 2027.
Okay. And you became chair when? Just the last couple of years or?
Yes. So my 3-year term extends through May of 2025. So okay. I started that 3-year term in May of 2022. So I'm kind of at that halfway mark right now.
Yeah. Well, and I know I've never been on a, a column. I've been boards that kind of boards you're on or chairing, but I, just a little board our condominium building board. And by the way, Kate and I, we live in the same building that former President Gustavus for Jim Peterson and his wife Susan.
Oh, is that right?
Living, yeah. And the same floor. We were there first and then they moved in. And I did podcast with Jim before he passed away and he was part of a breakfast group I hosted. Yeah.
Great man.
Yeah. Well, anyway.
Condominium boards can be challenging.
Oh my God. They were, I thought this is like worse than being at a faculty meeting. But in any case, I lasted 2 years and then went on sabbatical from Gustavus. So I was done. But I just know how much work it is in all seriousness and people who take the work seriously. And so I'm curious, because I had to think about this too, like why? What brought you to your decision, if it was a decision, to become involved in the board and then accept a chair position?
Yeah, well, I mean, it happened innocently enough, really, and started with bringing that direct investing experience and skill set. So I started it on the investment committee, which is one of the board committees, but where they actually have non-trustees as part of the committee for the sole purpose of being able to bring unique and specific expertise. So that's really how it started. And then it led to an invitation to join the Board of Trustees in 2015. And then moved to the executive committee where I better understood how all of the pieces fit together. And then finally as board chair.
Was it just your feeling good about your alma mater? I mean, I'm curious what really pushed you or motivated you to say, yeah, I want to be a part of the board.
Yeah, I think, together when I moved from to the chair role at Vardae in 2015, it was also coincidental with really thinking about other ways to kind of leverage my experience and really consider various volunteer and nonprofit commitments where my expertise would be particularly valuable. And I started with my alma mater, Gustavus Adolphus, partially as a direct recognition of the gifts that I'd received from an anonymous donor back when I was in college there. So it was my starting point, literally, for thinking about how to pay it forward.
Yeah. The I know that phrase gets used all the time, but there's real meaning to it. I've learned myself in life, paying it forward. So as chair now, I mean, I think of you're reading a ton of stuff. You're running. I don't know. It's a lot involved, right? Can you give us a kind of a snapshot view of what it is you do as chair of the board?
Yeah. So, first of all, at a super high level, what we're really trying to achieve is to be the stewards, right, of the Gustavus mission, of the Gustavus reputation, and of its resources. And so the board committees are organized in a way that helps us ensure that we meet our fiduciary duties. We're basically fiduciaries. So everything from a responsibility and role standpoint kind of rolls from there. The reality, though, is that college board chairs today seldom preside over meetings in this nice, quiet, relaxed institution, because higher education is in so much transition.
Yes.
There's change on many fronts. And so it's, it brings both some tensions, but to me, opportunities that test our capacity for innovation and adaptability. So if I'm doing my job well as a chair, I'm intensely focused on the mission, but also how do I leverage the power of the board, right? Mm-hmm. And then how do we actually, create capacity to anticipate change and be able to generate solutions? So when I think about what I'm trying to bring to the board or to the table as a chair, it's that strategic point of view, that financial acumen and experience that kind of now has been built up over the decades, but also being supportive of the president. Certainly you're presiding at the meetings and working with the president to develop the board agenda, but that's actually, crazy enough, the easy part of it, because all of the work that's happening between the board meetings to be able to, allow for the mission to go forward is where the bulk of the time and the work
right.
is. And if I'm doing it well, I'm also trying to bring some positive energy to it as well.
Yeah, well, I'm sure you're doing that. But yeah, what you just said is, I mean, I've experienced that again, just in a small way, but that so much of the work, right, is in between meetings, whether it's committee meetings or, I mean, you're doing just, I mean, the work is ongoing. It's incredibly important and time-consuming work. So I'm glad you have some energy for it after all everything else you've been doing and are still doing. You kind of touched on this. And so here we are, it's President's Day 2024. And we all know, anyone reading the newspaper knows that it's challenging times for higher ed. I'm the historian in me also knows that again and again and again and again and again in the history of higher ed in this country, certainly, its doom has been, pronounced over and over and over again. So there's a part of me that, thinks we have to take some of this with a grain of salt. On the other hand, there are huge structural issues like the so-called demographic cliff and maybe two more of those coming. But I'm just curious, from your perspective as a board, the board chair, and as an alum, when you think about, I wonder, how do you negotiate between your memories of the place and what you remember and sort of what it is now and what it wants to be, if that question makes any sense?
Oh, it totally makes sense, because I think one of the things that we have to be very careful of as any trustee or in any leadership role at a college and university is to take our experience and think we're going to cut and paste it into today's environment, and that's what we're, how we're going to kind of build the college for its success in the future. So I love I totally appreciate your point on being an historian and trying to, consider that history, but also be really intellectually honest
right.
About where we are and what some of those pressing challenges are for Gustavus and for the U.S. higher education more generally. And we are at a very interesting point. It's a fraught time.
It is.
For institutions of higher education, and it's not unique to Gustavus.
Right.
And you've identified some of these. We call it the demographic cliff, which can vary a little bit by regions in the United States.
Yes.
But look at fewer students are enrolling in college, and it's true in our local market enrollment. And so you're trying to seek increasing market share in a market that's declining in terms of student enrollment.
That's exactly right.
You've got technological innovations in delivery. It certainly got accelerated during the pandemic. You've got financial stress on families and questions regarding, is there still value to that college education, and particularly a liberal arts one? And then think of the competition, right? Online degrees, certifications,
right.
Employers doing in-house training.
That's right.
It's a bit of a litany of potential headwinds. So you really have to be thinking about the future in a way that considers all of those points while keeping the good things and the strengths that make Gustavus the college that it is.
Right. And that's a huge challenge. Just some years ago, John Hallberg, Trustee Hallberg, I think he's still on the board, John, and I had a book discussion, and it was by a guy named Andrew Del Banco. He's a faculty member at Columbia, and I think it's called What is College For? Or something like that. But he made the point, which I didn't know. I did not attend a liberal arts college. My wife did. She attended Bard College, even smaller than Gustavus in upstate New York. But I had no idea just how few students nationally attend a place like Gustavus. He has this assertion, and this is before things, you know, got even worse in terms of the so-called demographic cliff, but that you could fit everyone who goes to a private national liberal arts college in this country, you could fit into a good-sized university football stadium. And that's like, you know, when things are going well, right? So I love being at a liberal arts college, even though I didn't attend one. It's exactly the kind of place I wanted to be at in my head, and still want to be at. But it really is, it seems like it's kind of an American invention, but also maybe an endangered species. So yeah, the headwinds. So that's better. I like litany of headwinds rather than litany of woes. That's better. I made a note of that. Thank you. Makes me feel better.
I totally agree with you that while liberal arts colleges teach a relatively small percentage of the country's students, they are a foundational institution of American higher education.
Yes, and absolutely.
I think they really deliver something that's uniquely student-centric. So
yes.
I, despite this litany, I continue to be both realistic and optimistic about the power of that student-centric capability and mission and the need for leadership across, you know, our country. So
yes.
I continue to be realistically optimistic.
Yeah,
about the place that they play.
That's, I mean, I couldn't agree more. And I think when I did the honors date or whatever, I talked about to be a historian, it seems to me, I have to be both soberly realistic, but also, you know, optimistic at the same time. And history helps us do that. But nothing is a given, right? I mean, there are real challenges and there are real strengths to this place in all liberal arts colleges. But we have to make that case that, as you just said, it's true. If you look at who comes out of these student-centric small liberal arts colleges, it's pretty amazing. I mean, just looking, when I think about all the people, including you, I've interviewed for this podcast, my God, I mean, the alums, the current students, it's really quite astounding. And then, you know, I wonder, how can anyone not understand the value? But it's everything you just said, the cost, people saying, you know, who needs a college education? You don't need it, you know, blah, blah, blah. So here's to the liberal arts colleges and Gustavus. Obviously, money is a concern to the board, right? I mean, raising money, and I'm sure that involves, you know, a lot of your, not just you personally, but what board members need to do. But what else is on the board's agenda? I mean, like, where, I guess, you know, this is kind of a cliched question, but if you think ahead 10 or 20 years, even where is Gustavus ideally in your vision, speaking as an alum and, you know, not necessarily speaking for the board, of course.
Yeah, no, I love that. And maybe it's because I've been on the investment committee for so long that my lens goes right to the endowment. If I just made a bet with one of the board of trustees members that we'd have $1 billion endowment in that 10 to 20 year timeframe. Right?
I'll put money down on that.
Wouldn't it be exciting? Because what it does is it helps us meet the financial need and continue to attract and retain those excellent students, right?
Right.
So that's very much on my mind. I would love to see that we have a continued string of incoming classes of more than 600 a year. Wouldn't it be fun to have a waiting list?
I mean, yeah, that would be great.
It would be super exciting. And I guess fundamentally, I would really like to be able to look back in 10 or 20 years and watch the college continue to innovate to deliver that excellent student experience. I have to tell you, I am been particularly excited about some of the innovations that have happened even just in the last couple of years mm-hmm. with curriculum and experiences that I think Gustavus is really uniquely positioned to deliver. For instance, the signature experience that is now going to be an academic requirement for all of the students, and that the faculty committed to that idea, delivered the idea, and agreed in record time to create, you know, this experiences around internships and research and other significant learning experiences. I just think it's an excellent example of how we can deliver something for the students. We've increased our capacity in nursing, added our first master's in athletic training, right, and coaches to increase the capacity for student athletes. If we are continuing to do that over the next 5, 10, 15, and 20 years, I'm going to be very excited about what Gustavus, you know, can deliver for our students. And if I had to say one more thing, and that we should update some dorm spaces, like really.
Oh yes. I was waiting to see if that would come up. Oh my goodness. Absolutely. Yeah. No kidding. I'm not a big fan of dorms anyway. I got the hell out of the one at Northern Illinois University as soon as I could. I was in two, and that was enough for me for a lifetime. But yes, absolutely. And I've people who know me well or have known me for a long time, and it doesn't sometimes rubs people the wrong way. So I'm really glad to hear you say, I mean, you know, $1 billion, whatever. I mean, the fact is, I'm convinced if Gustavus had the kind of endowment that, let's say, a top 10, right, National Liberal Arts College has. My sister-in-law and her husband went to Williams. So, you know, if only, I mean, this college would be in the top 10. I really mean that. Certainly the top 20 easily because of the faculty, the traditions. I mean, you name it, the academic excellence. So that piece about money is just a reality. Just, yes, we need students too, of course. But yeah, how wonderful would it be to have a waiting list, right? Say, no, sorry. Yeah, because what we do as a faculty, the staff, I mean, that's done. I mean, we've got that. We've had that for a long time. But it's really, you well know, I mean, historically, the college is one, like a lot of small colleges, right? You train ministers and teachers, not investment people. God love them, right? But they don't make a lot of money. So that's number one for me. I was glad to hear.
Yeah. Well, and Williams is one of those unique endowments for sure.
Yes.
If we look closer to our own backyard and the MIAC, with a $300 million endowment today, that's almost doubled in 5 years. You know, we are really in I'd call it safe hands. Particularly against our more local area, right, of student enrollment.
Yes.
So I take your point. I would love to see it continue to grow on the pace that it's been growing in the last 5 years. And then it really, you know, helps us meet that financial need for students and continue, yep, to attract that,
right,
amazing student population.
Yes. Yeah. That's a point well taken. You just reminded me, I've repressed this traumatic memory. I think I'm pretty sure the endowment at Gustavus when Kate and I came in, my God, 1986, can this be right? Was $18 million.
Wow.
See, I mean, it was,
that's remarkable.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, it was like, it's amazing. Now, you know, it's a testament to the great stewardship of the, and that's well known about the place. I mean, that, you know, we made it. But yeah, when you think about 18 versus where we are today, there's progress, more to do, but we can do it. We're out of time, basically. This is so much fun. I do want to say, though, I did love that quote. I think of myself as a liberal arts graduate with some technical finance skills. I will be citing that you in all my classes. Do you want to just do a quick elaboration on that? What you mean? I think I know what you mean, but.
Well, I'd love to believe, and this goes back to our earlier point about the power of a Gustavus education and the ability to deliver critical thinking skills and a powerful kind of leadership in a world that's in desperate need of an authentic brand of business, political, and community leaders. So I'm really believe that those fundamental critical thinking skills and were, you know, really built at Gustavus, and I'm so proud to be a Gustie. And yes, my MBA, my graduate school, really built on those fundamentals by bringing in some technical expertise, specifically around finance and investing. But it really was the combination that has put me in a position to really thrive.
Yeah, that's just a great quote. It was published online somewhere. It was a Q&A, I guess, at Fordham, and where I saw that when you said that, and I I honestly, I'm nearly leapt out of my chair because that should be emblazoned all over the econ management department. I mean, every student should think about this because it's true, right? You can have all those technical skills, but without the other and the human skills, I mean, just how to, you know, you mentioned relationships earlier. I mean, all that stuff is part of the liberal arts, at least as I understand the liberal arts.
Absolutely. How do we relate spiritually and humanely to our fellow human beings, right? Overcome challenges, exhibit innovation, right?
Right.
And we need some courage to tackle those obstacles as they come as well. It's all part of the mix.
Well, I wish I were an investment bank or something so I could write a big fat check to Gustavus, but maybe one day. Thank you so much for all that you do and for taking time to speak with me. It's really been fun. Lunch on me at some point. Where do you work in Minneapolis? Is that where you come to the, or do you basically work from home these days? Or?
Yes, I'm a bit nomadic between Minnesota and my three daughters are all over the country, and I'm also have time in Florida. So
nice.
I look forward to our time together when we're back in Minnesota, and I'm just so grateful for today's conversation.
That'd be fun. Well, thank you so much, Marcia. Take good care, and we'll see each other at some point in person.
I look forward to it.
Learning for Life at Gustavus is supported by the Offices of Marketing and Communication and the Provost. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Gustavus itself.